How will America compete against China for influence on the African continent? This is Brief Before Impact. Welcome, everyone. I am Matt Parker. Thanks for joining us this week. Today's episode is going to dive into the issue of the African continent and the great power competition that is ongoing between the United States, China, and many other players around the world. We're going to dive into what is great power competition? What does that actually mean geopolitically and some types of definitions? And then we're going to dive into China's interest on the African continent, both economically and politically, and what the United States should be doing in order to counter that influence. Before we do, let me take a quick ad break, and then we will get to work. Welcome back, everyone. Let me just dive into what is great power competition. What does that actually mean, and how these nation states compete against one another for whether it's influence or economic interests, military perhaps. Let's look into that. So according to the Strategy Bridge, competition, it's just a primary category of means the state employs to struggle over security and prosperity with other states. So that's how states interact for these things of security and prosperity. It's via this competition. It describes the nature of interactions states engage in to proceed towards a specific end. It is a part of a continuum between cooperation and conflict. A sense of rivalry is arguably a defining feature of that competition. This distinguishes it from adversarial interactions of conflict and cooperative interactions typical for coexistence. The takeaway point here is that international actors compete with each other all the time. Now, like according to Kenneth Waltz, writing about history and politics, a great power can be determined through the criteria of population and territory, economic capability, military strength, political stability, and competence. So this gives great powers a relational advantage to each other's states' behavior, and that's arguably globally. Now, as John Mersheimer argues, again, writing about politics and history, he's arguing great powers seek more power, right? Also, they compete over gaining or affirming great power status, which makes status a strategic end. Their competition is geographically unlimited, therefore global, and takes place, at least in theory, in all dimensions of national power. Employing these criteria, the United States and China are today's contenders for great power status. So, with that kind of definition laid out of what this competition looks like, what is China's goal? What do they want with Africa? Now, there's actually dividing opinions on this. Immediately, the opinion is, oh, it's got to be economic interest, natural resources all over the African continent. But others argue, actually, it's about political influence and being viewed more as a global leader politically, more credibility, essentially. So, according to the RAND organization, what does China want with Africa? Well, China has four overarching strategic interests in Africa. First, it wants access to natural resources, particularly oil and gas. It's estimated that by 2020, at least, China will import more oil worldwide than the United States. To guarantee future supply, China is heavily investing in the oil sectors in countries such as Sudan, Angola, and Nigeria. Now, secondly, investments in Africa, a huge market for Chinese exported goods, might facilitate China's efforts to restructure its own economy away from labor-intensive industries, especially as labor costs in China increase. Third, China wants political legitimacy. The Chinese government believes that strengthening these Chinese-African relations helps raise China's own international influence. Most African governments express support for Beijing's One China policy, which is a prerequisite for attracting Chinese aid and investment. Now, finally, China has sought a more constructive role as contributor to stability in the region, partly to mitigate security-related threats to China's economic interest. So African governments look to China to provide that political recognition and legitimacy and to contribute to their economic development through aid, investment, infrastructure development and trade. To some degree, many African leaders hope that China will interact with them in ways that the United States and other Western governments do not, by engaging economically without condescendingly preaching about good governments, for example, or by investing in high-risk projects or in remote regions that are not appealing to Western governments or companies. Some Africans aspire to replicate China's rapid economic development and believe that their nations can benefit from China's recent experience in lifting itself out of poverty. So if their China's goal is starting with economics and looking for the benefits of new markets to trade in and so forth, in fact, if we look at natural resources like oil and gas, there is the opinion that it's not actually about economics. According to the theory Pyrrhot, a socioeconomist, he says, for all the talk of China's growing presence in Africa, its economic engagement is surprisingly limited. In 2020, Africa accounted for 4% of China's trade with the world. In 2019, the continent accounted just for 2.9% of Chinese direct investments flows in the world. And since Africa is made up of 54 countries, 53 of which recognize Beijing, economic relations are even less important by country. Now, on the other hand, China accounted for about 16% of Africa's trade with the world in 2020, but there is no direct African investment flows to China. China was also the source of about $150 billion in cumulative loans to African countries between 2000 and 2019. So China is clearly important to Africa, but Africa's economic importance to China is very modest. For example, the Belt Road Initiative strategy, you've heard my episodes on this before, it is at the heart an initiative to better penetrate European markets, essentially the European Union, which are the primary destination for Chinese products ahead of Southeast Asian countries and the United States. Now, Africa, therefore, has very little part to play in the Belt Road Initiative, and the investment China has made under this moniker are heavily concentrated in Egypt and the Horn of Africa along the route to the Suez Canal. So if economics does not explain China's interest in Africa, you know, what does really? And Pyrrhot, again, arguing that it's more about political legitimacy, that in fact China is looking to be seen by countries that are not necessarily aligned with Western democracy and influence, but to be seen as got a seat at the table, you know, the global power who could lead an international order. It's much more important that for Chinese leaders that China is viewed at the top of a hierarchy, and they look at African influence and the continent as just ripe for the picking and ripe for opportunity to gain that trust, gain that influence on the continent. And essentially, with those 54 countries covering the continent, a tremendous amount of influence on the world stage, particularly in the United Nations. Again, according to Pyrrhot, he argues that China's relationship with the African continent, it's not a recent one. You know, official Chinese historians have been trying hard to trace back, that's all the way back to the dawn of time, but Chinese-African relations took on a new dimension when you look at the events of the Tiananmen Square in 1989. The repression led Western countries to sanction China, a shock as brutal as it was unexpected. Now, China's reaction was immediate. Beijing aimed at revamping its relations with the developing world, starting with African countries, none of which had officially disapproved of the repression that happened at the Tiananmen Square. Matter of fact, some of them openly approved of it: Angola, Burkina Faso, Egypt, and Namibia. African leaders continued to visit China on official tours at the time when Beijing was shunned by the West, and that period gave birth to a tradition. Since 1990, the Chinese foreign minister make his first trip of each new year to African countries. And as an extension of those visits, the regular summit meetings on the Forum of China-African Cooperation were organized in 2000, onward to, quote, meet the challenge of globalization and help China and Africa develop together. So as this relationship developed between China and Africa following the events in 1989, there was this anti-Western kind of pro-global South narrative that allowed for a deepening of ties with the African continent, and whose 54 countries each have a vote on the United Nations General Assembly. So that helps explain the peculiar rewriting of a history marked by the publication in 1999 of a book recounting the 50 years of Chinese diplomacy. And that telling, Africa appears to be a hero whose support helped the People's Republic of China push aside the Republic of China and Taiwan and join the United Nations Security Council, even if effective African support was, you know, actually very tardy. Today, China continues to reap the benefit of this African support on the international stage. Right now, at the United Nations, Chinese nationals head four different UN agencies. It's the only country to ever have so many directorates at once. And this is what Thoreau is arguing, is in fact, it is being able to scoop up all this influence on the African continent, moving to the United Nations, whereas, say, 20, 30 years ago, a vote were to come at the General Assembly and only a small percentage of African countries would vote aligning with China. Now it's overwhelming that so many African leaders vote in something that benefits China directly. And a big part of that has been that recognition from China to these African leaders and not doing necessarily what the United States or the West has done in the past, saying, hey, we will give you development aid, but you need to meet these prerequisites. We need to talk about good governance and environmental safety. No, China doesn't do that. And that's very effective and very attractive to some of these African leaders. So when we look at how the United States can kind of counter this effort by China, it's an uphill battle. First and foremost, right now, think about this. The last thing an American Congress is going to start spending money on is infrastructure projects in Africa to counter a growing China. We're a very divided political body in the United Congress that rarely passes any overwhelming type of legislation that's not along partisan lines. So I don't see how a body of Democrats and Republicans are going to vote, oh, we need to spend a couple billion dollars on building bridges in Africa in order to counter Chinese influence on the continent. How do you sell that to the American people? You know, whereas you've got so many other domestic issues that are more in front of their mind, obviously post-COVID pandemic, and you know, whether it's labor or job shortages and so forth, or inflation, a whole myriad of issues, Africa's not going to be on the front burner in any time soon as I see it. So when we talk about, you know, just U.S. engagement, again, according to the RAND organization, U.S. engagement on the continent of Africa, it in contrast to China, it concentrates on higher technology trade and services, as well as on aid policies aimed at promoting democracy, good governments, and human development. Now, while China's no strings attached approach may foster inefficient decision making and official corruption, according to RAND organization, Chinese engagement does not fundamentally undermine U.S. economic and political goals on the continent. On the contrary, Chinese-built infrastructure helps reduce business operating costs and expand the size of regional markets, increasing opportunities for profitable ventures by both indigenous and U.S. investors. So the RAND organization would argue that, matter of fact, China is not necessarily a strategic threat to U.S. interests in Africa because, in fact, our efforts or line of efforts between China and the United States have always been from a different approach. So according to American Progress organization, they would argue for to rebalance this relation between African countries and the United States, there's a handful of things that United States could do in order to start kind of gaining that market share back, if you will. For example, obviously in a COVID-19 world, donating more vaccines. I want to say at the moment, the fully vaccinated Africans are a very small percentage of the continent, right? So vaccines could certainly play a soft power move by the United States. Additionally, dropping the lecturing rhetoric. Historically, America has always told certain African countries in order to receive foreign aid, you need to improve certain human right aspects of your governance. This is something China doesn't necessarily do, and that is recommended that the United States back away from this tone as well. Refocusing existing aid and development programs in Africa, you know, increasing funding and support. There's a particular program called Power Africa And then obviously partnering with African governments to help develop laws that address challenges brought by China's economic engagement. You know, China's engagement with African countries, it poses risk and challenges to key interests, thinking about transparency, labor practices, and environmental stability. So the United States could help develop those local laws to mitigate those risks. And lastly, forming a coalition of export credit agencies to support vendors seeking to compete against, like, Huawei, for example, a Chinese telecoms firm, and Chinese state-backed loans. You know, American policymakers should stop warning African countries just against partnering with Chinese tech companies without offering those price-competitive alternatives. So these are a handful of ways the United States could start balancing, or I should say rebalancing, that market share towards our favor across the continent in order to benefit our engagement and our influence in the coming decades. So let me close out today's episode just thinking about our most likeliest and most dangerous courses of action. Most likely, in my view, China will continue along its projects like the Belt Road Initiative, for example, across the African continent, though it may actually experience some setbacks. Due to its role in the COVID-19 pandemic, some African countries just might be deterred to engage, at least on certain levels, with China because of the pandemic. And for the most dangerous course of action, in my view, it would be if the United States just lacks a clear vision in what to do with Africa and shrinks away from that engagement in any meaningful way. And such a policy would lead to a further deterioration of American influence across the African continent. And for such a geographically large space, in the necessity, especially in a kind of post 9/11 terrorism world, we need to have an influence with those governments across the continent, both from a mitigating security risk to future economic interest that could be from a development or any type of as economies across the world continue to migrate to more service industries, and the African continent just having such a large geographic area and large population. Overall, if America shrinks away from that and kind of continues down this isolation path, and rather than engaging in these certain unpleasant parts of the world, those power vacuums are going to be filled by other powers. And China is actively and aggressively going after that space. So thanks for tuning in today. I hope that you found this informative and useful as always. And I do hope you're picking up what I'm putting down. I am Matt Parker, and this is Brief Before Impact.